speaking last time of the standards of conduct and the attitude the spiritual seeker ought to have towards them. We discussed how these standards are erected by the mind of man to meet the developing situation in the course of his evolution of humanity. We concluded that each standard is relevant to the particular stage of development to which it concerns. Once man passes into another stage, the old standard ceases to apply and it is replaced by a new one. This being the truth of standards, it is indispensable that the attitude of an awakened man towards these standards of conduct should be flexible, varying as far as himself is concerned, understanding as far as the others are concerned. In the course of this evolutionary journey of the soul, there are, Sri Aurobindo points out, three main stages. First, the stage of physical life, which is governed mostly by needs and desires. Standards are evolved with a view to help man to exploit his environment and build up his life in terms of these two truths of that stage of life, desire and need. Standards come in to regulate his needs and his desires when they come into conflict with the needs and desires of others. The standards, which are first too individualistic, gradually expand, become elastic, so as to contain the needs and requirements of those around man also. On the part of the seeker, as he develops, there is a growing realization that this, after all, is only a preliminary stage. Once he steps into the spiritual life, he decides that hereafter there will be no more the rule of his personal creature comforts or of his vital or emotional desire. He surrenders these claims of his on nature to God. That, however, remains only the central decision. It has to be worked out. The whole of life has to be organized according to the central directive. But by the impetus of the past associations, the past karmic influence, nature does take its own course. Whatever may be the decision of the soul, whatever may be the direction given by the enlightened mind, there is a purpose. First is to exhaust the karma that has been forged in that direction. Second, to convince the vital part of man from which desire proceeds, that even when this desire is fulfilled, it does not bring the satisfaction or the contentment that was expected. A same desire fulfilled in the life of a worldly man has different effect. But when that very same desire is fulfilled in the life of a yogi or a sadhak, the effects are quite different. There is no elation. There is no lasting joy. One suddenly feels empty. One feels, was it all worth it? How much energy, how much time has been spent in the satisfaction of this desire, this need? Wouldn't it have been better to eliminate it at the very outset? Till this feeling of the vanity of desire, of the insufficiency of the desire life, dawns on man, the lower movement, the first stage, is bound to persist. Gradually, however, this pull of the lower desires and requirements of life ceases, it fails, and the inner orientation, the upward pull, asserts itself. In speaking of the society, once man has arrived at a sufficient expression of his impulse for personal aggrandizement on the level of desire, there comes in the next stage, an enlargement of his life, an extension of his ego, if you may say so, and that is the beginning of emotional life, of mental life, in which one comes into direct contact, an engulfing contact with the environment. That is the beginning of the rule of ideas, emotions, certain psychic influences, and the standards at this stage of humanity, human development, are wider, breathe more of the air of mind and idealism. But this too is not the end. After a certain stage, man does discover that even this larger edition of himself becomes a closed book unless society too advances. Society does not advance beyond the advance of the average man. It is the responsibility of the leaders of society, the leaders of, not of society, but leaders of thought, to give a push to the society and pull it up toward the third stage, when the compulsive hold of mental ideals gives room to the more flexible and moving standards of the soul. The highest that the social standards of morality, of ethics, can evolve is what Sri Aurobindo calls the sattvic ideal, the full man, manhood. But to arrive at the full manhood in terms of the sattvic virtue is not the goal. Sri Aurobindo points out elsewhere that the golden chain is to be broken no less than the leaden fetter. The chain of virtue, man-made, self-satisfying, self-complacent virtue has to be broken. Virtue is a relative term. Where there is vice, there is virtue. Where there is neither vice nor virtue, the real truth remains. So Sri Aurobindo points out that the next advance from manhood is towards soulhood, and after all, the soul is greater than man. It is here, when man arrives, when the advanced section of thinking humanity, aspiring humanity arrives, at this stage of soulhood, articulates to soulhood that the deeper impulsions of the psychic being, the higher influences of the spiritual reality begin to assert themselves, and a stage arrives when all man-made standards are relegated to the background, and each individual has his own standard relevant to his stage of development. Side by side with the emergence of this standardless state, standardless in the sense of common standard, there is an automatic feeling of understanding, toleration of the standards of the neighbor, whose standards are necessarily or may be at variance with mine. What is relevant, what is right for the development of my neighbor may not hold good to me, for me, but on that account his standards are not less true. They are true to him. All the standards in the eyes of the awakened seeker are true to those for whom they are meant. With this Catholic and universal outlook, the whole meaning of standards changes. Standards are regulating guides in the control, elimination and transcendence of the ego. What after all is the ego? Man is apt to think that he is the doer, he is the chooser, he is the sanctioner, he is at the root of all action around him. Analyzed properly, we find that this I, which is so loved, which is so prominent, around which we pretend to organize our life, is neither here nor there. If we look closely within ourselves, where this I is, you find, as you begin to look inwards, that the I simply disappears. There is an immutable, uninvolved, regarding witness. There is a witness soul. Go still behind, the witness yields to one who sanctions the activity. Go still behind, that yields to one who presides over action. Either way, it is not the I which is accustomed to think of myself, but it is something else. It is the soul. It is the inner being in its various poises of witness, of sanctioner, of the presiding power that we meet. Or look at the surface of being. What is it that effectuates? What is it that achieves It is an energy. It is a power. It is nature. It is a vast energy of nature, channelized into my individual mold. It is a universal force that flows into my channel and effectuates itself. So outside it is nature force, inside it is soul force. Where is the I? The I is nowhere. It is a fiction. The ego, the I sense, is a fiction erected by nature, evolving nature, as a point of centralization in this flux of life. At each level of our existence, as long as the centralization has not proceeded far enough, it is this ego point, the pseudo-self, the shadow of the self, that is being strengthened and organized. The physical body functions as a center for the reception of physical energies and storing of universal physical energies. Our life, the ego, the vital ego, the ego of the life force in me, it is the focusing point of the life energies that flow from all sides. Similarly, the ego in my mind is a point of reference, is the meeting point of the various thought movements, ideas, idea forces that continuously cross and crisscross the mental sky. Without this ego point, things would be in a continuous flux. So it is a strategy of nature to build up this ego entity till the evolving organism has arrived at a sufficient power of self-existence and self-development. Once the point of self-possession, self-existence as a separate entity has come, the purpose of the ego is over. The shadow has to give place to the real form which it pretends to imitate. The soul, the self, that has to come forward. It is the will of the soul inside, of the being inside, that has to replace the preference, the pseudo-choice, and the volition of the outer ego. In this process, man becomes aware of two powers in himself. First, the outer executive nature called the Prakriti in Indian philosophy, and related to it, the soul power inside, which is called the Purusha. The Prakriti and the Purusha, the soul and nature, these are in their dynamic movement two separate powers as they function in this world of ignorance. They are separated from each other. The nature power goes on working. The soul goes on regarding. In the very regard, there is the sanction for the work of nature. At a deeper level, as I said, the sanction reveals itself to be a participation. That participation reveals itself at a still deeper level as the presiding influence over the activity of nature. This relation, this realization of Purusha and Prakriti, soul and nature in oneself, is the first step. First, because it is not the last. Behind this truth, this dichotomy of Purusha and Prakriti, one point I missed. In order to realize this double poise of Purusha and Prakriti, it is first necessary that one detaches oneself from the activity. It is only when one disinvolves oneself from this preoccupation with the nature activity. In some part of the being at least, unless he stands back and watches what is going on, he cannot feel the demarcation. He cannot feel the freedom from nature unless at a certain point he develops the habit of detachment. With detachment comes the witness poise. Thereafter, it is a matter of process till one becomes fully aware of the various poises of the Purusha, of the soul in oneself. Behind this double truth of Purusha and Prakriti is a more conscious manifestation of the divine reality as the Bayun reality of a more conscious, fully awakened, presiding soul, the Ishvara, the God, and an equally conscient, an impartible power of the same God, the Shakti. The difference between Purusha, Prakriti and Ishvara and Shakti is this. Purusha and Prakriti are two separate powers who in their interaction, interplay, keep the universal movement going. Ishvara and Shakti are not two separate powers. Shakti belongs to the Ishvara, embodies the will of the Ishvara and functions as she does because of the presence of Ishvara that she carries. Ishvara himself is not separate from the Shakti. It is his own power. It is his own projection, the projection of his will, backed up by his vision, that is the Shakti. They are one reality, bifurcated into two, actually poised into two statuses for the purpose of manifestation. After the realization of the Purusha and the Prakriti comes the deeper and the more fulfilling realization of the Ishvara and the Shakti. Mark, this means that in each one of us there is the double reality. Whether one is a man or a woman, both the poises of the Creator as the conscient soul and his conscious puissance, they are embodied in each individual. The Supreme Will is there above, projecting itself in this manifestation, in this double poise. As one goes through these stages of detachment, observation, realization of the reality of the Purusha and Prakriti, then enters into the truth of the dynamic relation between Ishvara and Shakti, the puny will, the power of choice exercised by the ego is long dead and gone. It is the higher and the supreme will alone that is real. Naturally, this change, this replacement of the individual by the supreme will does not come in a day. In the course of sadhana, it proceeds through three well-marked stages. First is when one is open, there are moments when the individual will is in tune, gets in tune with the supreme will and functions as its channel. It is an intermittent operation, not continuous. The second stage is when the possession of the individual will by the supreme is extended in periods, more and more, working in form of intuition in the heart, working in the form of a command, till this periodical position, this periodical guidance yields to a gradual sense and truth of identity with the supreme will. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Invoking of the Ishvara Devata. How is that related to Ishvara Shakti?
When Gopāda speaks about Ishvara Devata, how is that related to
Ishvara Devata and Ishvara Shakti? There is no gender in that context. You can say it is Ishvara as Shakti, Ishvara himself as Shakti. It is not something separate. That means you invoke the Godhead that is called Ishvara. Ishvara implies an identification and a sovereign rulership over the universe, which is his creation, as related to the creation. There are other deities who are not so related to the creation. It is to distinguish this poise of the divine that the deity of Ishvara is referred to as the Ishvara Shakti. When one invokes Ishvara, the invocation of the Ishvara Shakti is implied.
In one's daily work, how does one go about the realization of first the Prakriti, Purusha relationship, and then the Ishvara Shakti relationship?
If one develops the habit of carefully observing of what one does in the routine, in the day-to-day work, one does find lot of movements, number of activities which do not faithfully reflect his own aspiration his own central will for consecration, his higher aspirations. These movements which happen in spite of his will to the contrary, they are the movements of nature. They are the movements of prakriti. It is this mental observation is there. The isolation of those lower inferior activities follows. With this constant observation accompanied by detachment and the suppression and rejection of the lower movements, one becomes conscious of a certain purification that goes on in the movements of prakriti in keeping with the developing aspiration of the Purusha. A part of the mind is always detached, should be always detached from when you are doing, observing things, pointing out to you the errors, the pitfalls, the wrong appearances which your mind is giving to what you are doing. This observation, analysis, mental analysis of oneself and one's movements, mental honesty to oneself, that is the first stage of being aware of the play of Purusha and Prakriti in oneself. One has to shift one's center of consciousness from Prakriti, from outer nature, inward, towards the soul. Systematically, without mercy. Once you do it sincerely, persistently, it develops into a habit. And even in moments which are normally unconscious, that habit asserts itself. And whether you yield to the movements of nature or not, you are conscious at that time that this is a foreign movement to which I am yielding. So what is first required, as the mother says, is sincerity. Once we have chosen, the light of sincerity must be thrown on all that we do and think and feel. Sincerity grows on itself. If we allow a certain amount of dissimulation and insincerity, it is spiritual suicide. There is the evolving nature is helping everyone who wants to release oneself from the clutches of the outer nature, lower nature. The higher nature is pressing upon man. There is from below the soul is aspiring. One has only to be sincere and throw one's weight in the right place. After a time, there need not be even a struggle. Once the will is made up, once the sincerity is entire, the lower nature, the external prakriti, drops by itself. And the enlightened and the higher nature takes its place. Prakriti has to be replaced by Shakti. Lower nature has to yield to divine nature. That is the course of sadhana, at any rate, is integral yoga. The field of nature is not to be rejected. The operative power is to be changed. The approach is to change. The whole direction of life movement changes automatically. And each individual realization has a dynamic effect on those around. Each successive victory of my soul over my lower nature, external nature, has a simultaneous effect on similar situations in my fellow sadhaks. It strengthens the strength of the soul in others on an occult level. That is what Sri Aurobindo means, that in a collective sadhana, the victories of each sadhak have a great effect on the sadhana of others. So, whether other people are progressing or not, whether others are doing their part or not, the ideal seeker minds his own achievement first, because that is the best help he can render to others.
When you spoke about the change from the ego to the soul, and that the use of the ego passes after a certain point, one thing that I thought about is when Sri Aurobindo talks about the evolving of the whole creation or of each individual, he always talks about how the thing that passed is taken up into the next stage, transformed. And the question of what happens to the ego in that being taken up in transformation relates to another thing, which is that if the ego is developed fully before its time comes to pass or be taken up in some way.
Ego is not such an easy thing that will go. You see, it survives in 100 forms.
Uh-huh.
There is what Sri Aurobindo calls, there are so many avatars of ego. There is first the physical ego, the ego of the life force, the vital man, the mental, the ego of the knower, the knowledge. He knows everything. Other people may not know, but I know all the knowledge I have got. There is the ego. And as somebody said, the highest and the worst form of ego is the spiritual ego. I am spiritual, I am superior to all others around. I am helping them. Pity flows from me. See, and it is called the worst form of ego, because a man who claims to be spiritual, a man who has in some part perhaps touched the spiritual consciousness, it is the least excusable for him to have this ego. So this ego point is a fiction. It has no real truth. It yields, it merges in the truth of which it is a simulacrum, it is a shadow. When it just merges, it has fulfilled itself. In our language we may say the ego is dead, but actually in the course of evolution, seen in the proper context, it has served its purpose of centralization. And once the center has opened up, the true being has emerged, it just merges in it. It merges in it. Just as the analogy does not hold completely good, in love, the divine love, for instance, the lover and the beloved, these two entities obtain only up to a certain stage. But when the divine beloved reveals itself, the lover simply merges. There is none thereafter to love and one to be loved, none to pray and one to be prayed. It is one reality. That is a fulfillment. It is not the death of love, it is the crown of love. Similarly, each formation by nature has a purpose. Once the purpose is fulfilled, its part is over. It has not been useless, but to prolong its existence after its use is over is a human perversity. which only man is capable.
When Mother said last New Year is about the time for falsehood to end, does that imply that what you just said is true, that the role of falsehood, whatever purpose it had in the past, is no longer real, and it's only human perversity that keeps falsehood alive?
Hmm. Yes, that is true. Falsehood has been rooted out from its base in evolution. Falsehood as a product of the original inconscious nations emerging into ignorance. This ignorance and its product separativity, separation of one from the other, separation of universe, the creation from the creator, all these developed into a positive entity, a formation called falsehood, which is the very opposite or antithesis of truth. Now, with the emergence of truth, the supramental truth in principle, falsehood has no place to exist. As long as truth has not revealed itself in a plenary way, on the earth scene, falsehood could survive. But with the advent of the supramental consciousness on earth, the age of truth has begun. The era of falsehood has started receding. So whoever puts his weight on the side of truth, his task is easier than it was ever before. The pull of inconscience and falsehood is not so strong on the seeker today as it was, say, a decade ago. We have seen how this downward pulling and obsessing difficulties of the lower creation, the nether nature, have lost their power to be terrors that they were once. One has only to aspire intensely and wish for it, for the help to come and the difficulties to lose their edge. If difficulties survive in a persistent manner, it is because something in our nature still clings to them. Something. If we are sufficiently sincere in our self-introspection, we can spot the erring member. Pardon?
When you spot the erring member, what to do then?
You have to be firm . Turn it over to the Divine to whom you have dedicated yourself and follow it up. What is called the follow-up action, which is important, is never to listen to its suggestions. To make it a habit, to give it, as Mother once told me, to give it a knock on its nose every time it lifts up its mouth. After all, it is not one's own individual strength that deals with these situations. We are open and are carried by a great power, a consciousness power of truth, and we have only to tune ourselves to it, to invoke it to work, and that does it. as long as we have the sense of the doer, that I am the sadhak, I am the seeker, and I am to fight the battle, that's the difficulty. Once I surrender myself centrally, it is a process of working out this surrender in detail. Surrender in detail, that's the crux of the sadhana.
I'm a little bit confused as to the difference between the descent of the consciousness of the Superman and that of the supramental consciousness. I was wondering if perhaps you could speak of the former somewhat, whether in fact it means the possibility of the manifestation of supermanhood on Earth now, or whether it is something else.
The difference is between a superman and a supramental being. A superman is not a supramental being. A superman is the next evolutionary species after the human stage is transcended. His mind, the human mind, develops into its original prototype, the supermind. In principle, he is in possession of the truth at that level. The truth and the self-effectuating will are at the summit of his being. He is in possession of it. But the whole of his being is not yet formed in terms of the consciousness of the supramental level. When the whole of his being, down to the material self, is so transformed in terms of the supramental consciousness, when the forces of disintegration, death and mortality are completely conquered, and the whole system is a real physical embodiment of the divine consciousness without deviation, without diminution, without dilution. That is the supramental being. That supramental being can come on earth, can manifest on earth, only after the race of Superman have organized life for the purpose. What Sri Aurobindo calls, or I am not sure if Mother has said it, the intermediate race between man and the supramental being, that could be the Superman. Sri Aurobindo has sufficiently written to distinguish the Superman of his conception from the Superman of the German philosopher. He is a higher type than man. In possession of the truth mind, in possession of the supreme light, but not yet completely transformed.
I'm wondering specifically about the descent of the consciousness of the Superman in 1969.
That is supramental truth in principle. Until that principle which has been manifest on earth has organized itself, effectuated itself in the whole body of earth and rendered negatory the forces of mortality, the supramental consciousness cannot be said to have been completely manifest on earth. The descent has to take place, just as the first descent of mind took place eons ago, and it took so many millions of years for man, the mental being, to be the Lord of creation that he is today. A time gap has to be there between the first touch of the supramental consciousness or force or power on earth and its gradual spreading, organization and establishment of itself. The descent of life force, the life from the life plane, took place long before life became organized in physical matter, dead matter. So the descent, you may say, is the inception of the beginning of an eventual manifestation of the supramental consciousness.
Let's do this one more question.
Yes, please.
Because I'm still not at all clear about it. The descent of the supramental consciousness in 1956 is one event. A very vast, very, very vast event. And then there was the descent of the Superman consciousness in 1969, which seemed, in a way, a much smaller event, and yet it comes 13 years later, during which time one would imagine that certain things had been under preparation since the time of the descent of the supramental consciousness. What exactly does this later descent mean to us? What does it embody? Or what possibilities does it open to us? Further than the 1956
descent. It means the organization of the supramental consciousness has arrived at an articulate stage. When you speak of the consciousness of the Superman, it means the earth evolution in a certain center of manifestation has arrived at a stage where that consciousness has been articulated in the form of a Superman. Till then it was not. It was just and a possibility that had been opened up, a light that had broken through darkness, took roots on earth. Thereafter, it has to spread, it has to grow, and arrive at a certain fixed entity form called the Superman. There is a still larger stage to be covered before the possibility of the supramental being is formed. At present, what it means that anyone who opens oneself to that universality of consciousness, exceeds his ego, opens to love, the universal and the divine love, can become a Superman. This possibility was not there 15 years ago. This possibility was not there even on 29th of February 1956, when the descent of the supramental light took place. It opened the gates, as it were. Thereafter, whatever has poured and continued to pour, it has to be canalized, it has to be built into shape, given a certain personality, as to effectuate itself as a superman, the consciousness of a superman. The mental consciousness, for instance, is spread over all creation. Even animals have a certain mind. They have got a cunning vital mind. Developing stages of mind are there in the animals. But it is only at the human stage, at the stage of man, that the mind comes into a definite, articulate, self-conscious stage. Similarly, you can say, the supramental consciousness has arrived at a self-conscious, self-effective, self-aware stage on earth. But the road to transformation is still to be trodden. Is being trodden. Yes.
One question about the chronology of this evolution. You said there are eons had passed from the descent of the life force to its formation in man, and something like millions of years from the descent of the mind force until it became effective or active in man.
As man.
As man.
Yes.
Then, is there any chronology given as to the time man has been on earth in that sense with the mind?
The science, modern science, has calculated on the basis of fossils, geology and all these things, a certain chronology. But that's all that we can say, because in our scriptures the accounts are at times fantastic and they look more symbolic than actual, the accounts. So we do not know, but it's certain that many ages have past, whether it is millions of years, more millions or less millions, we do not know. But in the absence of better proofs, I think we should rely upon the evidence given by scientists.
Well, that's the reason I asked the question, because science is now seeming to come to the point that it may have only been 300,000 years. But as to Roger's question, it seems that this is an incredible leap from 56 to 69.
Now that is because it is not the nature in ignorance that is now evolving. It is illumined nature, it is the divine nature that is at work. And man, the awakened man, at any rate, the human souls that have been opening themselves and allowing themselves to function as the channels of the higher nature, of the manifesting nature, Godhead, they are fully awakened beings, illumined beings. That makes all the difference. Just as Sri Aurobindo says that the whole evolution from man to God can be compressed in one human lifetime, provided there is the will and the necessary drive for it. Left to nature, it would take thousands of years. But it can be done within 50 years, 100 years. Similarly, once the supramental force is on earth, things will be telescoped in an unimaginable manner. What has all gone on is a solid, slow preparation for the stage of precipitation that is at hand. The past can hold no analogy as to what is to happen now.
Is it possible that the Matri Mandir is an instrument in hastening this transformation?
It is both an instrument and an expression. An instrument for manifesting the consciousness that it is, to which it is to be a monument, a living monument, and also as the consciousness forms itself in the mold of the supramental truth, it will be the material expression. It is developing as a material expression. The more it rises, the wider and the firmer base it gives in the material, on earth, in physical matter. Mother wants that this consciousness that she embodies is to be received and made living not only in human bodies, but in all matter. This will be the representative earth matter. The success of Matra Mandir will be in a sense the measure, the barometer of the success of the manifestation of the supramental consciousness, the consciousness for transformation on earth, in the person of the mother. The difficulties that are